everybody. I'm Lisa Burwell, your host of V-Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. And I'm excited to sit down and talk with Margaret Biggs, who is a artist of just a prolific artist that has honed her craft over the years that we featured her in V Magazine several times. She's also been in our first coffee table book, Home by V, with her beautiful work. And we'll be showing that, and we'll be talking to Margaret about her journey as an artist, which is quite fascinating, and she's very candid. Margaret, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. It's nice to be here.
Good to be with you. So I was getting ready for this podcast last night thinking about, oh, wow, Margaret's been in our magazine for at least like 9 or 10 years ago. So This is like not a brand new relationship or an alliance between your art and showcasing you in the magazine. And then this past year, you've been in it a lot more in a bigger way and part of our book and part of our book series. And it's been really fun reconnecting with you and getting to know you better than we did before, and your journey. And I know that in life, you know, nothing's constant, and we all have like ebb and flow and highs and lows. And your walk has been interesting, and you've had to put your art down sometimes that we'll talk about, and then you always pick it back up again. And one of the fascinating things then in knowing where people have come from and what their background is and what they were doing and then how they got to where they are right now. And in your story, when you were 18, I think, that you were signed by the Eileen Ford Modeling Agency.
I was actually 19.
Oh, you were 19? Okay. And then you went to Europe or Paris?
I started in New York. I had been to 1 year of college at LSU. So I was born and raised in Pensacola, and I had never lived anywhere else. I'd only been out of the South once at that point, and that was in a camper. So I had done some work with a local photographer, and Eileen Ford was given a copy of a menswear catalog I was in. And she called our house one day and asked my mother if I would move up to New York City and join Ford Models, and that was the summer of my freshman year in college, and I moved to New York.
Wow. What was that like? A Southern girl that's never been out. Like, did you love it?
I did. I was so naive that the fascination of the city I was just enamored with it. I think that if I had been a bit more knowledgeable, I would have been scared. But the fascination of the city, just, I loved it. I remember those first rides on the subways, you know, looking at all the different people from all different areas of the world and just
soaking it in.
Oh, I loved it. Mm-hmm. I just did. I still love New York City. I lived there 5 years.
Did you live there for 5 years consecutively?
Well, I did spend, you know, time in Europe, probably 16 or 18 months within, you know, I had a New York City address, but then I would go to Europe and work and come back. So once I did it for 3 months, and then once I did it for 10 or 11 months.
So what was the modeling life back then?
Well, it was much smaller. It was Ford, Elite, and Wilhelmina. That was it for women. There was also Zoli for men. So the industry was much, much smaller, more intimate. The great big traditional studios that the photographers had at that time and old warehouses down in the garment district or where have you. New York City was a different place. I mean, there was, you know, you didn't go to Central Park at night. You didn't go down to the Bowery at night. The Tribeca was just a couple of restaurants and maybe a gallery or two. There just wasn't much down there. I saw a photographer that I worked with regularly there a couple years ago. I was out on Long Island, and he was talking about that. It was much more intimate, you know? It was.
Yeah, it was a different place.
It was, but it was for everybody in the 80s. I mean, the early 80s was just a different, very different era.
Correct.
Yeah. It's changed everything.
So that you had shared a minute ago that getting signed and becoming a model change the trajectory of your life or your career?
Very much so. My life, yeah. Very much so. I mean, I knew nothing about fashion or the modeling. Really didn't have any interest. I just knew it was my ticket to Europe, and I don't know how I knew that. Mm-hmm. But I had a burning desire to travel to Europe, and I knew my parents couldn't afford it. So I said yes. I just had this very adventurous spirit, and I still do, mm-hmm. you know? And so I joined up, and it was hard. I didn't make the friendships. It's a very disconnected world, modeling, you know, because you don't work with the same people every day. You're off on appointments, working at different studios, seeing different people day in and day out. You don't form the friendships like people do in college or in their first jobs outside of college. You just don't. Yet, there's a price to pay for everything. I was being paid to go to Morocco on a photo shoot from Paris, for example. You know, they were paying me to dance on the beach in the British Virgin Islands. You know, it's good fascinating. Gig. Yeah. Yeah, it really was. Yeah. You know, I went to Istanbul by myself. When I look back, I go, I can't believe I went there by myself in 1984. You know, but I did. I did this huge Pepsi campaign that were these, was Diet Pepsi. People still remember it.
Do you have pictures?
Yeah, because it was right after Diet Coke. The first Diet Coke came out, so it was Diet Pepsi's competitive drink.
Come back.
So it was a huge campaign. It was huge. And it's just, it was a real gift to have lived that life throughout my 20s as a model. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. But once again, there's a price to pay for everything.
Right.
You know, I don't have the friendships most people do from that period of their life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I wouldn't change a thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, during that period of time, were you an artist then?
That was going to be my major at LSU before I was asked to move to New York and become a model. And I had always taken art classes every semester in high school. Mm-hmm. So I was taking art classes in grade school, and that was going to be my major at LSU. But I tried to go to school in New York as a model, but inevitably you get some week-long job in some other city or in the Caribbean or whatever, and it's just very difficult to do. So on the one hand, you have a lot of free time and you make your own schedule, but on the other hand, you can't plan anything else, you know? Mm-hmm. So by the time I was in my late 20s, I'd pretty much had it with modeling, and I went and enrolled in art school. By then I was living in Chicago, and I'd gotten married, and I enrolled in school at the University of Illinois at Chicago, which was a highly conceptual art school at the time. And the Art Institute was even more so. But we were very fortunate. There was a group of us that Carrie James Marshall came in to teach art just temporarily while a professor was on sabbatical. And he ended up staying. And he was really taught us the technical skills, like how to draw the human figure, how to mix color, how to stretch a canvas, that we weren't getting from the other instructors. So there was a group of us that followed him around from class to class. I took at least 6, maybe 8 classes from him, and we maintained our friendship. But there's things that he taught me that still come to my mind while I'm painting. It's interesting. I mean, how often that happens with me even still. Mm-hmm. So that was the late 80s into the early 90s. And during that period, I did have one child. By the time my second child was born in 96, I didn't quite finish school, but I kept taking classes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if some major life event would take me to a point where I just couldn't make it to class anymore, you know, I just kept enrolling. If it was the Evanston Art Center or a private class from some artists in Glencoe or where have you, when I was up on the North Shore, I just kept my hands in it. Mm-hmm. I kept trying.
What subject matter of painting would you paint back then?
It was always the same.
It's a similar.
And that was something that was really interesting. And one of my earliest classes at UIC, Of course, most of the students were 10 or 12 years younger than me at the time. And I was soaking so much of it out because I really wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. And I remember a teacher asking us what our favorite subject matter was. So I was thinking back to when I last made art regularly in high school, many 10 years before. And she said, those very same subjects will most likely be the subjects for the rest of your life because that's what you're passionate about. Mm. And sure enough, it's been that way for me. I mean, it's the fascinating thing about the creative process is you can continue to improve and explore for your entire life. I mean, there's color and composition and line and subject matter. And I mean, or even you look at Monet and how many times he painted haystacks. I mean, you can take, it's like Kerry James Marshall used to say, it isn't what you paint, it's how you paint it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, that's what's so fascinating about the creative process is you just, and when you're, you know, you'll choose what you want to paint, you get over the hump of the intimidation of this blank canvas, and then the painting, it really does take on a life of its own. You don't, and you want it to, because that's when the magic happens, you know? You want to flow with it. You want to get into the zen of it, you know? That's in all the spiritual texts I read, they often use the example of your mind becoming so focused and so still and so comfortable with what you're doing that the process takes over and your mind is almost not involved anymore. It's like that's when the magic happens, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
It does. Oh. I get it. Yeah. I totally get it. So I read something very recently that you had written about that your love of the beach and your fond memories when you were younger, mm-hmm. with your family and your mm-hmm. siblings and how much you loved it and it meant to you. So a lot of your subject matter are mm-hmm. shells and mm-hmm. the beach and the serenity and the peace of it that I'm looking at the art that you have now that I absolutely love, or your beautiful magnolias and mm-hmm. just like stunning, peaceful, ordered, reverent work. I mean, these mm-hmm. are all the words that I think about when I think about your work. My husband, Jerry, from the second that he saw your work years ago, and he's quite particular and somewhat critical, said that he thought that your work was exceptional. This is like 9 years ago.
And that's an architect who's highly visual. Yeah. That's correct. Nice compliment.
It is.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. I mean, it was like not the norm for him to kind of gush about too much about someone's work. So he gushed. And so it made me turn around and take note.
Yeah.
Very much take note. And I admire it so much.
Thank you.
It's really, really beautiful.
Thank you.
So tell about the story about how you kind of fell into the business. And I'm not sure where you were living then when you realized that you could sell your...
So I started having my paintings professionally photographed up in Chicago in 2008. And when I moved down here in 2009, I started doing art festivals. And I would have the prints made in high definition. These are archival quality, a very high quality on paper, and Madam and sell them at festivals. And I did quite well. Festivals at the time, and still today, are more about getting your name out there, about exposure. And I did that for 5 or 6 years. And then I found myself caring for my parents. So I had the teenage son and my elderly parents to care for. And my mother was quite sick. And so this really disrupted the flow of my career, such as life, you know. We all have to make priorities. You know, we have our priorities. And being there for my parents was very important to me. Mm-hmm. And it gave me the opportunity to live in their beautiful home on the bay. And we were... you know, raised there and very much lovers of the water and of nature. That's where it comes from, my parents. So as far as there came a point, my mother was very sick with dementia, and she died 2 years after I moved into the duplex on the bay.
I'm sorry.
It was a blessing. Mm-hmm. And then my father lived another 4.5 years. And during that period, I just kept painting. And whenever I'd get consent from a collector or I'd donate a painting, I would take that painting to be photographed in high definition. And I wasn't even really sure what I would do with it beyond selling matted paper prints at art festivals or when I'd have an open studio. And after my father died in 2019, I realized, really, I was married and I moved to Cleveland for a year, so there was more. You know, I've moved on average every 4 years for 40 years.
That's hard. Moving is very hard.
It's so disruptive. Mm-hmm. So I was up in Cleveland for a year, and I looked at my files and I went, holy cow, you know, I have over 75 of these, you know, high definition files where I can take these images and blow them up, oftentimes larger than the original, and it maintains the quality, you know, without it breaking down or seeing the texture of the canvas, where it's just these beautiful reproductions of my art on canvas that look almost like originals, mm-hmm. or they basically look like originals. Mm-hmm. And now we're offering them, of course, on paper and metal. And so I've started selling them, you know, nationwide. You know, I'm just selling them. And it's very freeing because the way I paint, if you look at my art closely, you see it's slow. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the gradation color, the very little brush strokes a lot of the time. I'm meticulous with the composition and the color and the subject matter and the accuracy. I mean, it's stylized. You know, it's stylized realism, mm-hmm. is how I refer to it. People recognize it, but I there's a lot of thought and time that goes into every painting on every level. So it's time consuming.
You can tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, Van Gogh, right. Incredible genius, but you can just tell, or here a better example would be Jackson Pollock. Mm-hmm. It didn't take a whole lot of time for him to cover those canvases. As fabulous as his work is, if you look at my art closely, you can see it's just time consuming. And so this passive income of selling the prints, it not only enables people that can't afford my originals to have my beautiful, soulful art in their homes, it also gives me the time to put into painting, mm-hmm. you know, because it's bringing that passive income to me so I can just like pull back, right. and spend more time in my studio. So, and it opens it up, you know, I'm in, it's interesting. I have had a lot of medical facilities and hospitals buy my art and originals early on, but now my art's too expensive and they're buying the prints. And it's because it's so peaceful, mm-hmm. well before I could verbalize it, they saw it because of what they call the evidence-based healing art movement, where it's been proven if you have peaceful, nature-inspired imagery in hospitals, it helps people heal because it reduces anxiety and stress. Some say it raises the serotonin levels. I mean, so it does all these things and people just feel better about their environment. They rest and so they heal. So they've proved this. That it's actually peaceful, nature-inspired art helps people heal. And I was in like 12 or 15 hospitals before I even learned about this. I was like, oh my goodness, I've been doing this for 10 years. And so now I'm starting to target it because how inspiring is that?
Very.
You know, for me as an artist, mm-hmm. it's like, this is
rewarding.
Yeah. It's incredible. You know, but really that's was the intent from when I first started painting seriously, which was after the birth of my oldest child. So, he's 30 now. Mm-hmm. And, I was living in Chicago in a very rough neighborhood west of the infamous housing project, Cabrini Green. It was a very rough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I was married to their father, a photographer who had bought this fabulous old terracotta facade bank building with 30-foot living room ceilings in a beat neighborhood. It was a rough neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, and
sounds kind of groovy.
It was very groovy. It was a fabulous old bank building, uh-huh. but it was a rough neighborhood, and I couldn't easily get to a place of natural beauty, you know, just mm-hmm. because of the difficulties in a major city finding parking, and mm-hmm. then the winters, and yep. you know, there was nothing. If I walked my son to the nearby park, which was about a half mile walk, I'd have to put my foot on the tricycle to keep from somebody from stealing it. Mm-hmm. It was just a really rough neighborhood. Wow. And so I started painting the piece I found in nature, and this was an unhealthy marriage. I had no friends nearby. I had no family mm-hmm. within, you know, 500 miles, and I was very lonely during that period of my life. And it was just, he wasn't very involved. I didn't have anybody to help me mm-hmm. Emotionally, not even their father in raising them. And so it was a very lonely period of my life, and I couldn't get to nature, which has always been my refuge. That's always been, since I was a little girl, where I would go for emotional healing, and I couldn't get to it. And so I started to paint it in my basement. And then even after our divorce, we were living in a beat-up rental to keep them in the same school system we were in at the time on the North Shore. You know, I'm talking plastic kitchen cabinets and, you know, plastic pink tile in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And I had this little teeny corner of the kitchen where I kept an easel up. That was when I was like, I've got to do this. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten into real estate. I had to work. So I kept that easel up. Mm-hmm. And I advise this to anybody that wants to get into art or painting, is to just find a corner of the house. I'm talking 4 by 6 feet. Mm-hmm. It was a corner with a counter. And I put up that easel where I could see it every time I went through the back door. So that as I'm working on this painting, even if it was only 2 or 3 hours a week, the challenges I had, because no matter what you paint, no matter how long you paint, as the painting evolves, challenges come up. And you've got to figure it out, you know, whether it's a line or a color, or something's just not working. You don't know quite what it is. And if you keep walking by it, it's in your subconscious, so that the answer to that issue, that whatever it is, that is keeping you from really making the painting right, it pops into your mind at the oddest times, you know, like at the grocery store line. You're like, oh, that's what I need to do. But the trick is to keep it on an easel in front of you where you can get to it, even if it's only for 30 minutes in the morning before you got to get the kids up. It's in your consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then that creative process just is always kind of churning in the back of your mind.
It is. So at that period of time, were you selling art then when you were there?
No, that was when I was selling real estate. I got into real estate. Mm-hmm. So after my divorce from their father, I got into real estate. And this was pre-cell phone. And I needed to be nearby because I had a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old. And basically my 10-year-old had to, you know, babysit.
Right.
And so I was just down the road at an office, you know, where I could rush home. It was right. half an hour away, the dumpiest little rental you've ever seen. And but I wanted to be nearby. And I wasn't selling. That was where I got started, though. It was in a restaurant in Wilmette on mm-hmm. Chicago's North Shore, and a doctor picked me up, as a matter of fact, back to that evidence-based healing art. And she had 2 offices, and she ended up buying something like 25 of my paintings and decorated both of her offices, one in Chicago and one at Old Orchard, a famous mall on the North Shore of Chicago.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's what got me started. It was a little restaurant
yeah.
in Wilmette. And then I went through some more troublesome mm-hmm. years, and ended up going through complete bankruptcy, which is what brought me home after 30 years to Pensacola, because my standard of living was so much better. I mean, I didn't have a bed or a car. I'm talking solid. Losing three properties. I'm talking real bankruptcy, you know. So I came home. One son was in college, and the other one was in beginning eighth grade. And I was thrilled to be home, you know, once again.
Feels good to be home when you need to be home.
Yeah, well, there's nothing like the Gulf Coast for me, or just the simplistic beauty here takes my breath away. This isn't the magnificence of the Grand Tetons or the Rockies or the Big Sur. This is a much simpler beauty. And, it's just sky and sand and sea. And the palette is so simple. It's white and blue and green. And there's little treasures of seashells that so many people overlook. It's a quieter beauty. It's my home. You know, I think that's just a lot of it, too. It's what gave me solace when I was a child. When I'd come home during all those lonely years in Chicago.
Were you writing then when you got home, or were you actually?
The writing started in Chicago.
Okay.
Not long before I left, as a matter of fact. I wrote, see if I can remember it, one of my first poems. I am a shell of who I once was, a shell of who I will become, worn smooth with time, beautiful from experience, broken yet whole, deep in my body, singing the song of the ocean when I'm still and all is quiet and I listen. Well, it's probably the first one I wrote. And that's
beautiful.
The poetry, interestingly enough, it doesn't always come to me when I paint, but when it does come to me, I am painting. And once again, it's that quiet, meditative state. I got into meditation when I first moved to Chicago in 1986 and happened to have a great teacher those 23 years of living there. Someone who truly lived the life of a saint, really, for all the challenges she's been through and the love she radiates. And the peacefulness in her heart. She was such an incredible inspiration for me and still is. She saved my life. Meditation saved my life through some very devastating, very traumatic years. And that spirituality, that meditation is what comes through in my art, because I get into a meditative state when I paint. You become so one with the process that... there are no other thoughts. It just becomes you and the brush. I mean, not always. You know, there's times when you're just filling in an area of color, and there's times when you're trying to figure out the composition and you're just struggling, which is the same for a composer or an architect, or, you know, but then it starts to come together and you become so at one with the process that nothing else is entering your mind. And that's when the magic happens. And that's when the poetry falls into my head, because inevitably that broken shell or that group of trees or those waves of the water, you know, I start thinking about things that I've read, whether it's from a Buddhist text or Christianity, the Bible or the Tao. Something comes, because all of those, I mean, if you think about it, you know, Jesus spoke about quiet, the kingdom of heaven is within, you know, or he would go out into the desert for 40 days to be alone. Well, that's, you know, to quiet his mind so that he could be in contact with God. And so all of that in a lot of these texts that I've been reading for decades, they talk about that, and they'll use an example of artists who can get into that state. And I know it so intimately. largely because I'm so isolated for so long. All I had was my children and my box of paints, mm-hmm. you know, and I couldn't get to a place of nature. So I painted it.
Mm-hmm.
It kept me sane.
You manifested it.
Yeah, literally.
Through your paintings.
Yeah. So that's when the poetry comes to me. And then what I start to paint, like the broken seashells, is the easiest thing for me to explain, mm-hmm. where every time I paint them, and this also had to do with being a very beautiful young woman, and I'm dealing with my looks fading, which, you know, is inevitable if we're lucky enough to reach middle age. And, you know, we all get a bit beat up by life, like a seashell that's been beat up by the waves and faded by the sun. We're not as pretty as we once were. Mm-hmm. And yet when that shell is broken, the univalve shell, the beautiful inner spiral is revealed, which is still so often perfectly intact. Mm-hmm. And you can think of that as our soul, as that deep inner goodness, which is within all of us. And it isn't until you're beat up by life, oftentimes, that we pay attention and we start working on our inner life. You know, for me, I didn't have any family around. I had very few friends on the North Shore, nobody to help me with my kids. You know, I went through bankruptcy, and you just go, okay, what's within my control? Well, what is within my control is how am I going to handle this, mm-hmm. and what kind of person I'm going to be. And, I messed up countless times, lost my temper, been unkind, mm-hmm. but I just keep trying. Mm-hmm. And that's what it means to work on the inner life. Mm-hmm. And so as our outer beauty fades, our inner beauty can start to shine with intent, and if we allow it to, and if we keep trying, you know, and recognize where we failed and promise and try not to do it again.
Right. So. Well, that's what it's all about, the journey of life.
Yeah.
It's twists and turns and bumps in the road and moments of complete zen and happiness, but
it's not easy.
No, that's still good.
It's still wonderful. It's beautiful, mm-hmm. especially if you plug into it, you know, because like anybody else, I get down and I get hard on myself. And mm-hmm. and when I go out to the beach, though, it's so easy to tune into that inner peace on a great, big, beautiful beach with nobody around. You're just like, whoa, you know. And so if you can get into that mental state and stay there, even when you're working or doing the laundry or, mm-hmm. you know, having a disagreement with your spouse, mm-hmm. you know, magic starts to happen. And you think they're just coincidences. But mm-hmm. why do we have more of those good coincidences when we're in a good mental state? Mm-hmm. You know,
you're open.
There's some sort of correlation there.
You can hear. You know, your openness allows you to be able to hear a lot of things that you can't hear when things are noisy and messy. And,
right.
You know, that's kind of the trick of it all, is to stay as open as possible.
Yeah.
You know, I've always found it fascinating to learn more about an artist and everything and the passion that you have and how you're describing your life and your walk. I mean, it does really bring your beautiful art even more beauty, knowing the background and your process and how much you love it and how you mm-hmm. think. And that's one of the best things that I think about, like us having a conversation like this, because, you know, nothing can, you know, this kind of trumps the written word. I mean, you know, it can go so far. I mean, the written word can go very far and it's very important, but I think adding this onto it is, you know, unlike anything that you could possibly do unless you're hearing from the artists themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that pretty awesome, pretty cool.
I appreciate
the opportunity. And I thank you for being very candid and sharing your walk. And I know your art is magnificent.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
And so tell our listeners and our viewers how they can see your work, your web address, mm-hmm. your Instagram handle,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, just so that people can start following you.
It's, my web address is simply margaretbiggs.com, and, it's BIGGS. And then my Instagram and Facebook account are Margaret Biggs Fine Art.
Great.
So,
well, we're glad you're here. I'm glad you're back home.
I love it here.
It's good. And thank you so much for your time and for your candor. So love it.
Thank you, Lisa.
All right. Well, everybody out there, thank you so much for watching V-Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. And thank you, Margaret. Appreciate you being here. And I loved our interview. Have a good day, everybody. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.